Council, let me ask you a jurisdictional question before you start.
Yes, sir.
Most of these cases were appealed to the Court of Appeals, and then a motion was made to transfer here because of the, at least the constitutional issues were within the exclusive appellate jurisdiction of this court. And as near as I could tell, the Court of Appeals went both ways with great rapidity. So at least two or three times they kept him in the Court of Appeals, at least two or three times they sent him here. So there seems to be not at all any consensus as to whether the claims you're raising are even more than merely colorable. Do you agree with my scorekeeping here?
For better or for worse, I am the only public defender who handles SVP appeals. The East and the South have all immediately transferred cases here. The Western District has kept two SVP cases that raise these constitutional issues, and the George case said they were merely colorable. I disagree. This court has exclusive jurisdiction to determine the validity and constitutionality of the SVP Act. 632.505 has never been interpreted or examined. So you have exclusive jurisdiction over that statute, if nothing else.
Which kind of takes us to the question of whether we ought to be inspecting 632.505 at that level of detail, that heavily fact-dependent, case-by-case in terms of releases on the front end in committal cases, or whether we should leave that sort of detailed inspection and analysis to release cases, which we have yet to hear.
532.505 is not the only change in the statute that hasn't been reviewed. So there are some other amendments as well. But I think it is critical that we look at the implications of 505 on the rest of the statute, because it changes the nature of civil commitment in this state. And the amendments that went into effect at the same time that provision was enacted eliminated the characteristics that this court has relied upon to declare the proceeding civil. Hendricks found it so significant to look at the back end. What did release look like? What happened once you got committed? So it looked at what is the release process? What is the standard of or the burden of proof in release? Who must petition for release? How often must we do that? And if there's discharge? I believe if those things would not have been in place, that the United States Supreme Court would not have found Hendricks civil. So it's no different now that we're looking at Missouri's SVP law. We need to look at the exact same things. Once someone gets committed, if commitment is punitive, then we surely must address how someone gets there. If we know the end result is lifetime confinement without the ability to ever get out, then we have to put protections in place up front that
minimize. Is there a distinction between confinement and custody? You keep saying lifetime confinement because when they're released, they are never out of custody. Is there a distinction between confinement and custody?
For a liberty interest, I would say no. Are there some practical differences, like physical custody? Sure.
The Constitution treats somebody incarcerated or securely mm-hmm. confined mm-hmm. precisely the same as somebody who is on the street with no obligation other than to not commit further sexually violent offenses. Really?
So someone who's on supervision, like probation or parole, still has due process rights.
They're either serving a sentence for a crime
sure.
or they have volunteered to be on probation rather than have the sentence imposed or executed. That has nothing to do with what we're talking about.
Well, it does, because they are constrained by the government, and the government has authority over them and can put them back in a prison or incarceration setting should the government find they violate one of those terms, whether they agreed to abide by it as a term of probation or it was involuntarily imposed upon them as parole. The practical reality of SVP commitment in Missouri is no one is physically released and let out. There are a handful of men since the Schaefer opinion, the federal opinion, who have been conditionally released by agreement with the state because they are so unwell, they have been sent to a secured nursing home. They're not out living on the street. They're not out living on their own. To be conditionally released under the statute requires a finding that you either no longer suffer from a mental abnormality or you no longer meet the statutory more likely than not risk threshold. So if those criteria abate that justify commitment, you are still not released and your liberty is not restored. You are only conditionally released. And the reality is those men don't really leave the sorts facilities. They built an annex, which they put a wall down the hallway where my clients are housed. Men in the annex who are conditionally released live on one side of the door. Men who are fully committed live on the other side of the door.
Well, that's I understand that's the real facts, but that's the trouble with trying to analyze in the current context of facial attack, constitutional attacks, the statute as written and the statute as applied. The statute as applied may have problems. The statute as written may not have those same problems. It isn't ordinary that we would attribute one to the other.
Well, I think we can look to the Schaefer opinion. It made factual findings, and it tells us exactly what the reality of that commitment is.
But so we have to accept the federal district court's findings then?
You don't. But the problem in the initial trials is this. I am not permitted to put on any evidence of what might happen the moment after the verdict, good or bad, if my client is released or if my client is committed.
And the reason for that is because once, if your client is committed, then you can present that evidence in some type of other action before this court.
And in theory, that would work. I can tell you, in the last month, there have been two conditional release hearings. And the state is arguing that my clients cannot put on evidence of what their release plan would be and where they would go. Because the only issue is, do they have a mental abnormality and do they have this risk? So that's in spite of the fact that the Department of Mental Health has prepared a release plan and is submitting conditions that they say, if this particular individual is released into the community, he is not at risk and we can trust him. And by the way, here's what we know he's gonna do. Here's this plan that we trust him to follow based on his time here and commitment. We believe he'll be accountable to this. So in practice, no, we don't get to present that at any point in time in state court.
Well, would you get it presented as then a petition to modify the conditions of release? And at that point, then you get to show why the conditions that you suggest are more than adequate?
I don't know. The reality is we don't ever get that far. We have judges who are denying uncontested petitions for conditional release.
But again, it's not that you don't, that those are not serious problems, but they're serious problems with respect to a procedure we're not now reviewing. And the difficulty is to try to bring those real world problems into the context of an appeal of a commitment. And how and under what authority and in what cases in the past have we ever looked at how a statute is being applied in the real world case by case to determine on the front end a facial constitutional challenge to a conviction or in this case a commitment?
Well, I think there's precedent for looking at facts of other cases that are similar to this as guidance. We don't have to accept the findings of Schaefer. I would say that is true. I would encourage the court to do so.
Now, but I have a question regarding it. What's the status of Schaefer in light of the, because Schaefer, the trial judge, applied strict scrutiny in the court that directly.
No, sir. Judge Fleisig applied rational basis.
She did apply, right? Okay.
Yes, sir.
And well, what is the status of that case? Is it on appeal in the Eighth Circuit?
No, so that was just the liability phase. The remedy phase is continuing. I do believe that there's...
Wasn't there a settlement in part, or is that...
It was rejected.
Okay.
So there was a settlement proposal. It had been rejected. I got an email in the last week from some of the federal attorneys. It's been set for a hearing in June, but they thought that the AGs weren't available on that date, and it might get continued.
So it's an interlocutory order.
It's not even a final judgment.
It's not final as to liability, no. Correct.
And is it correct that the trial judge there has asked for briefing concerning the Eighth Circuit decision as to whether she'll have to vacate and redo it a whole thing?
Yes, sir. I think the challenges in the Minnesota case were very different than the ones in the Missouri case, and they were very different. And Judge Fleisig didn't go to the extent that the Minnesota judge did in the weeds of some things and some of the specifics in saying you have to do this very narrow specific thing instead of saying general principles are this, it doesn't comply with general principles, if that makes sense. So I think our opinion was much more narrow and focused, and the issues that were presented were very different as well. Judge Russell, did you have a question?
No, I was just commenting on Schaefer with an interlocutory order.
Yes. And you had asked me a question, Judge, and then someone else asked over here, and I got
it's
a little
It's an occupational hazard.
But I think in these cases, why we can look at some practical examples to what Schaefer said, this issue can and should be decided based on the face of the statute, based on the fact that these protections that are inherently necessary in this type of proceeding have been eliminated from the plain language. Like, there is no discharge. Like, if someone is conditionally released, they can be brought back into custody, even though there's no new finding that they have a mental abnormality or meet the threshold.
Is it possible, though, that one of the reasons that this care, custody, and treatment continues, and that at a minimum a requirement of no further sexually violent offenses be committed would continue, is that it may be virtually impossible to convict this person of a subsequent sexually violent offense once there's been a judicial determination that they're mentally ill and unable to control their behavior?
I don't think that's true. As a practical note, I know that my clients have assaulted one another on a few circumstances, and they have been criminally convicted even while they were in sorts and have gone to prison and then get transferred back to sorts. So I don't think that's possible. But if that rationale is true, then my client couldn't have been criminally convicted in the first place. Let's say Mr. Reddick, if his offenses are the product of pedophilia and it is uncontrollable, which is the basis for civil commitment, then how did he have enough control to be culpable in the first place?
Did he raise that defense in his earlier criminal conviction? Because that's how that happens.
Sure. I don't think that pedophilia has been recognized as a basis for an NGRI commitment or a diminished culpability. As a trial attorney, I certainly wouldn't be the one to argue that to a jury. I wouldn't want to make that argument. I don't think it would work.
In order to recommit under the statute, it doesn't appear there has to be a finding that the person is dangerous or is mentally ill, but just that they violated a condition of release and the violation of the condition was sufficient to render the person no longer suitable for conditional release, proved by a preponderance of the evidence.
Right. So it's effectively authorizing physical confinement and civil commitment without either of the two mandatory findings that the Supreme Court have said are required for commitment to be constitutional. Are there any further questions? This is your last chance of me today. No, perhaps not. I get to come back.
You do get to
come back.
Don't worry.
I think I have one more chance.
May it please the court. I think Judge Wilson's questions strike right to the heart of the matter. We're here on an appeal of a determination of whether a person met the criteria of a sexually violent predator. The release procedures at this point are completely hypothetical and not properly before this court. And in fact, all of the constitutional arguments that have been raised here have their genesis in that Schaefer case, which has been pointed out repeatedly is not only non-final, and as my understanding is the remedies portion has been vacated for further briefing on the Piper decision, as Judge Wilson indicated. But it's also important to note that that very decision found that the statute was not facially unconstitutional, but only unconstitutional as applied to those specific persons. Now, to try to find the statute facially unconstitutional based on the release provisions presupposes that those release provisions in the statute will never change in the future, even though they have changed in the past. It will presupposes that the way the department carries out the release procedures will never change in the future, whether by the department's own initiative or by a binding court order that forces the department to do things differently. It really is asking this court to make a hypothetical advisory opinion that this person is going to be illegally deprived of some release procedure, which at this point he's not even eligible for, and we don't know the specifics of how his particular condition will fit into those release procedures and what he's entitled to. So,
do you agree, though, that all of the provisions of the statute are considerations in whether or not the statute is punitive?
I think that there's some credence to that in looking at the overall purpose and effect of the statute as to whether or not it's punitive or not. But
and the fact there is no discharge or no unconditional release would be one of those factors the court should examine in determining if it's punitive.
It's a factor to consider, but I don't think it necessarily results in a finding that the statute is punitive because, an absolute discharge, I don't think, is a necessary requirement of that. And I think a conditional release can effectively operate as the equivalent of a discharge in that kind of a situation.
But in effect, under the amendments to the statute, it's a lifetime commitment.
It's lifetime a commitment, perhaps, but certainly not custody in the sense, or certainly not lifetime confinement, I think, and that distinction was made earlier.
Am I correct in reading the statute, though, that the things you have to prove in order to initially confine the person as an SVP, that they have a mental disorder which makes them unable to control their conduct and likely to be violent?
Right.
I'm not using the artful phrase.
You're on the right path.
Exactly. Yes. But it does appear once they're conditionally released, which presumably is because they've been found not to present that kind of risk and not to have a mental illness, there's no they can even be recommitted without a finding that they are at that time dangerous and meet the conditions for initial confinement.
Well, of course, they met the conditions for initial confinement
initially, they can be recommitted under sub 7 by preponderance you show they violated probation, not that they have this mentally violent disorder.
Well, I suppose in some ways that's kind of similar to the sexual registration statutes, which are civil in nature and regulatory, and certainly if you violate those are lifetime registration requirements, you violate them, you're subject to going back to prison, perhaps being charged with another offense.
If you're convicted of that violation, if you're
right.
found guilty,
right.
as opposed to...
But again, even the return to commitment, I have to believe, is subject to some challenge, so... there has to be a judicial finding of a probation violation.
Right, by a preponderance of the evidence, absolutely, and you have a right within 7 days of return to ask for a hearing, and you get a hearing, and if they don't prove that, you can't be reconfined, but you're still not released.
You're certainly, as a technical matter, you're certainly not, but again...
Is Missouri the only statute in the nation that has lifetime commitment, no discharge?
I believe, to my understanding, what I've been told is the other states all have a discharge provision. Now, what the lifetime aspect of it, I'm not quite sure how that works. If the court has questions on any other matters, thank you.
Thank you.
The release procedures are not hypothetical. They are mandatory and spelled out in the statute. And there's nothing hypothetical about lifetime commitment in this state. And one of the things that happens at trial that makes me so furious, to be honest, about this law is that the jury is given an instruction that tells them if my client is committed, they'll be committed to the custody of the Department of Mental Health for care, control, and treatment. Even though this court has routinely said the only issues at trial are whether or not they have a mental abnormality and whether or not that mental abnormality causes their risk to be more likely than not. This court has said treatment is an ancillary purpose and has held that DMH is not obligated to provide any specific type of treatment or treatment that effectuates any kind of change. It is an opposite, then, that treatment as an ancillary purpose, the state gets to give a jury instruction and argue based on that instruction the jury should only send someone for treatment. It's not reality and it's not the element, and there's no evidence about it at trial. This doesn't limit the persons who are committed or safeguard against an erroneous commitment. It expands who gets committed. And because of this instruction, the state gets to argue just send somebody for treatment. In Mr. Reddick's case, the state argued and he needs treatment, and he needs to be in a secure facility. In Hopkins' case, they argued, the instruction tells you what happens. If he's committed, he goes for control. He goes for care, and most certainly treatment. That's what this is about, care, control, and treatment. That's what we're seeking to do, to get him into a mental health care facility for control, care, and treatment. We're just talking about getting Hopkins into an environment where he can have the care, control, and treatment that he needs. And in Mr. Bushong's case, finally, you get to decide whether he needs to be made to go to treatment and to learn how to apply these concepts. So you have the opportunity now. He says he doesn't need treatment. He says he doesn't need to go. He needs to be made to go to more treatment. Treatment is not the issue. The issue is whether or not my client meets the criteria for commitment and if that commitment is constitutional. I encourage this court to go and watch an SVP trial. It is like no other jury trial that happens in this state. It is crazy. It is fast-paced. Things are happening. I would argue rules don't always apply. But I think it would give you a lot of perspective, and you would see firsthand exactly why I am passionate about this and exactly why it's this court that must act, that must re-examine the constitutionality of this law and the commitment of my clients. Are there any further questions?
Thank you. Okay. Case will be submitted.